worst part of this is that Anya James restricted the diets to the children, which led them to become severely malnourished.
An Anchorage woman is charged with severe child abuse. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, May 18th. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, students from Western Alaska take the stage at the Smithsonian in Washington, D.C.
It was cool, but I was kind of shy to be on stage.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Full Circle. Full Circle grows, picks, and delivers fresh, certified organic produce year-round. More information about their 400-acre farm and their organic partners at fullcircle.com. And by NEA Alaska, promoting excellence in public education for Alaskan children through investment in education professionals. Online at neaalaska.org.
A 50-year-old Anchorage woman, Anya James, is in custody charged with the abuse of her adopted and foster children. James appeared in Alaska Superior Court today after her arrest Tuesday. James has been charged with 10 counts of kidnapping because she confined the children and 6 counts of first-degree assault. Anchorage Police Department spokeswoman Anita Shell says the children were physically and emotionally abused.
They were confined to small rooms. The rooms were monitored and alarmed so that Anya James would be notified if the children tried to escape. They also had video monitors and audio monitors so that she could monitor their conversations. But the worst part of this is that Anya James restricted the diets to the children, which led them to become severely malnourished and stunted their growth and prevented them from going through puberty through their teenage years. In fact, several of the children were removed from James' home, had to be hospitalized in October of 2010 because they were malnourished.
According to the police, James had adopted 6 children and had an as yet undetermined number of foster children in her care. In October of last year, detectives operating on a tip began investigating James. 4 children were removed from James's home at that time.
The children were removed from the home and hospitalized in October of 2010. It took the officer, several investigators actually, several months to put the case together. They interviewed up to 8 children who had been living in the James home in the last decade and put together a very solid case.
Shell says James received $750,000 in state adoption subsidies between 2000 and 2010. James is living in the affluent Anchorage Hillside neighborhood in a home valued at $560,000. James homeschooled the children and limited their outside contact. James is being held on $100,000 bail and is prohibited from contacting her adopted children or any children under the age of 16. Police believe that James may have adopted other children before 2000 and are asking the public's help in gaining information about James's activities.
Well, what we have is photographs that were taken by officers after serving a search warrant, and these photos were hanging on the wall of what looked to be a family surrounding Anya James, and there were several children in the photos that the officers could not identify, and they believe that they may have been previous children that could have been adopted by her, but we don't have that solid information yet.
Shell says that Anya James lived in Eagle River prior to moving to the Hillside area in 2001. An all-night search turned to tragedy this morning as the bodies of 2 missing clam diggers were found in Western Cook Inlet. Officials are still investigating the incident that killed a total of 5 men after their skiff apparently ran into trouble. KBBI's Aaron Selbig has the details.
The Coast Guard received the call Tuesday afternoon that 5 professional clam diggers had gone missing on the west side of Cook Inlet near Polly Creek.
The Coast Guard responded with a helicopter, a C-130 fixed-wing aircraft, and one of our patrol boats to the area to help the employees of the clamming company to search for their missing employees.
That's Coast Guard Petty Officer First Class David Mosley. He says that one of the men was quickly found on the shore, deceased, and soon after, at about 6 p.m. Tuesday night, a Coast Guard helicopter crew spotted 2 more men, both deceased, about a mile offshore.
The search continued through the night using multiple helicopters. An Alaska State Troop aircraft also did a search of the area. And then this morning, around 11 a.m., the final two individuals were found.
The two men found Wednesday morning were not wearing life jackets, but the three found Tuesday were, says Mosley. The cause of the incident is unknown. Weather conditions on Cook Inlet were mild Tuesday and Tuesday night, with light winds and 2-foot seas.
We don't know what led up to the individuals ending up in the water. The boat has yet to be found. We have not been able to find the vessel. And we are working with Alaska State Troopers to investigate and see what we can find out to what led up to this tragic accident.
All five men were contractors working for Nikiski-based Pacific Alaska Shellfish. The company, according to its website, is a seasonal plant that focuses solely on harvesting Alaskan razor clams along a 6-mile stretch of beach between Polly Creek and Crescent Creek on the west side of Cook Inlet. Jason Moore is a spokesperson for Pacific Alaska Shellfish. He says all five men were independent contractors who were paid by the company based on the poundage of clams they collected.
But despite the, you know, the fact that they're contractors and not direct employees, the company has worked with these individuals for many years in some cases. And so they were very experienced, and they certainly considered part of the family at Pacific Alaska Shellfish.
The identities of the victims have not yet been released, pending notification of next of kin. In Homer, I'm Aaron Selbig.
Alaska Supreme Court Justice Morgan Christian has been nominated by President Obama for a vacancy on the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. Begich recommended Christian for the opening created by the retirement last year of Judge Andrew Kleinfeld of Fairbanks. Christian must be confirmed by the U.S. Senate. If she clears that hurdle, she will be the first Alaska woman to serve on the Ninth Circuit. Former Democratic Governor Tony Knowles picked Christian as a state superior court judge in 2001. Republican Governor Sarah Palin named her to the Supreme Court in March of 2009. Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski says Christian is an outstanding choice, and she will support Christian wholeheartedly through the confirmation process. The Alaska Supreme Court has suspended the law license of former U.S. Attorney Wevley Shea, finding, quote, clear and convincing evidence that he violated professional rules of conduct. The High Court adopted the recommendations of a disciplinary board, which called for the license to be suspended for 25 months. The board also said Shea must demonstrate that he is, again, quote, mentally fit to return to practicing law before applying for reinstatement of his license. An Alaska Bar Committee last year found that Shea had a conflict of interest in representing the sister of a former client in a family dispute. It also found, among other things, that Shea had acted unprofessionally in court pleadings by using language or displaying conduct the committee described as demeaning, frivolous, and outrageous. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a closer look at the climbing disaster last week on Denali.
It was a situation in which there were very, very few options open to those climbers.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
Scientists studying the health effects of chemical groundwater contamination in North Pole say there's not enough data to draw definitive conclusions on toxicity. An interagency team is looking into pollution from historic spills of sulfalane at the North Pole refinery that have migrated into the water table, affecting about 200 private wells. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, this week scientists shared limited findings with wary residents at a public meeting.
Sulfalane is a solvent used in the crude oil refining process, and it's highly soluble, making groundwater contamination a major issue if there's a spill. North Pole is the worst case of such an incident, and there hasn't been much research on health effects. A few available studies, including one translated from Chinese, focus on short-term, high-dose sulfalane tests on animals. Jim Durant with the Federal Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry says based on available data, the risk to human health from sulfalane-tainted water appears to be low.
The levels of exposure here in North Pole, Alaska, are below levels that we know cause harm in animals, and by a fairly wide margin. You know, in some cases over 100, sometimes even 1,000, depending on the, you know, whether you're looking at acute effects or, you know, more chronic effects.
Only very low concentrations of sulfalane have been measured in North Pole groundwater, but it's unclear how long some residents in the impacted area drank it. Sulfalane spills occurred at the refinery in the 1990s under previous owner Williams and at some point migrated off-site into the water table. Contamination of wells was first detected in fall of 2009, after which current refinery owner Flint Hills began providing affected residents with bottled water. Ann Ferris with the State Department of Environmental Conservation, who's been working the sulfalane issue from the start, says the recommendation for people with contaminated wells remains the same.
People should not drink impacted water, and they should not use well water, impacted well water, to garden.
The gardening recommendation follows a state study last summer of local produce watered from sulfalane-tainted wells that found the chemical in leafy vegetables like lettuce. Ferris says the state is trying to put together a study to better understand the toxicity of the sulfalane contamination. Some people at this week's public meeting were upset about the lack of definitive health information. In an exchange with a woman in the audience, State Representative Tammy Wilson of North Pole said more study is needed.
The bottom issue keeps coming back, and I know this is what the last thing on earth you guys want to hear, is they need to do more studies because the state does tons of studies.
It's not but, the last thing.
But the bottom
last
line,
thing I want to hear is bull cancer.
Right. And I'm trying to tell you the straight up of what
you know,
it is.
Don't try to tell me that you've studied other studies that were all unsuccessful right. on rats and that it's safe for you because you don't know that.
Exactly.
We won't know that for 20 more years.
So all we can do now is try to figure out, is there a solution to getting it out of the soil and making so it doesn't get any worse than it already is? That's really, to me, what they're looking at to do. But I just wanted to give that option.
Health isn't the only contamination issue. Some meeting attendees expressed concern that their properties are losing value. Borough Mayor Luke Hopkins was explaining that there's only minimal evidence of that when he was interrupted by a man at the meeting.
What do you think's going to happen with the impact? Are you going to buy a piece of property with sulfalane in the ground? Are you going to build a house on it?
That's why I'm saying the assessors are...
Oh, good night.
...are watching the house sales. When people go to Flint Hills and some houses are sold...
Do you have any common sense?
Let me finish, please. Then you can yell at me. So from that point, we're watching it. There are some trends that are starting to show up.
Now we got a trend.
Well, that's how we have to go on. It's what happens with neighbors' houses that are sold. So if you've got direct information, send it to the assessor's office so we can get that information.
Flint Hills has drilled two new public wells for the city, which is seeking funding to extend municipal water piping to the sulfalane-contaminated area. Meanwhile, Flint Hills is offering property owners combinations of cash and bulk water tanks with free water delivery or well water filtration systems. North Pole resident Lewis Merrick said it's a good deal because local groundwater has always been poor.
We got people here who want to sue over the fact, well, my house may be devalued by $5,000 or $10,000 because I no longer have a well that can produce drinking water. Baloney! My house, the water is not drinkable without running it through two filters and a water softener, even before we found out about sulfalane.
Merrick said he's accepted an offer from Flint Hills. Jason Weiner, an attorney for a man who's suing Flint Hills and Williams, says affected residents need to assess their options.
For some people, that deal works. For other people, it doesn't. And you got to realize at the end of the day, if you don't like it, and they say, no, I'm not going to give you any more money, you got to figure out whether you're going to sue or not.
Weiner says residents technically have until a statute of limitations deadline in November to file suits, but that given the time it takes to put a case together, the deadline is effectively much earlier. A judge has already ruled against a request for class action status. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
District 1 Republicans have officially launched a recall effort against Ketchikan Representative Kyle Johansson. Johansson came under fire after his decision to walk out on the House Majority Caucus and gave up his position as House Majority Leader last year. KRBD's Maria Dudzak reports.
District 1 Republicans issued a press release detailing the reasons for the recall. Republican Chair Dick Koos says though District 1 Republicans initiated the process, individuals from other parties also are sponsors of the recall effort. Koos says there are many reasons the decision to recall Johansson was made.
Representative Johansson ran on the fact he'd be the majority leader in the majority caucus, and he obviously had it, and then he gave it away.
Johansson says the accusations are unfounded. He says he respects the right of the group to file the petition, but questions the reasoning and motivation. Johansson says he believes the recall is a power play instigated by a small group.
All of the voters should be able to decide who the representative is, and they've done that. And what will happen here is if they're successful, then Dick Koos and Laura Antonsen and those folks will be the ones who get to choose who the representative is for the next year. And I just don't think that's right.
State law does not allow a recall within the first 120 days of the term of office. Because Johansson was reelected last year, a recall application could not be turned in until mid-May. State Division of Elections Director Gail Fanumiai says the application process is just the first step in recalling a candidate. She says based on District 1 turnout in the 2010 November election, approximately 531 signatures need to be gathered in the initial application process. Fanumiai says state law specifies acceptable grounds for recall.
And the grounds for recall are lack of fitness, incompetence, neglect of duties, or corruption.
If the recall is successful, the Ketchikan-based recall committee will need to submit three names to the governor for consideration. The governor would then select a replacement for Johansson. In Ketchikan, I'm Maria Dudzak.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. The University of Alaska Fairbanks now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Begin your UAF fisheries degree at any major University of Alaska campus and finish in Fairbanks or Juneau. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
Last week, a horrific climbing accident on Denali's West Buttress route claimed the life of one climber and seriously injured two others. Todd Rutledge is co-owner of Colorado-based Mountain Trip, the company that organized the climb. Of the two guides and four clients on that ascent, four summited the mountain, but on the descent about 800 feet from the top, one climber fell, pulling three others down. I asked Rutledge for an update on the injured climbers, guide Dave Staley and Jeremiah O'Sullivan.
We're still waiting to see how their frostbite injuries heal. I don't have any real definitive update. Frostbite, regrettably, is a kind of wait and see how it heals type of injury.
We hear that Dave Staley's hands were very badly frostbitten. Can you give us any idea of how bad?
Yeah, Dave sustained pretty severe frostbite to his hands, and they're healing, but he's got a long way to go.
His reputation as a guide is unblemished. He's considered one of the finest. So can you tell me a little bit about his background?
Dave came up to the big mountains of Alaska and Canada in the late 70s and joined an expedition to Mount Logan in, I believe, 1979. He started guiding on Denali in 1982 and has pretty much guided continuously up there since then. He's our most senior guide. He's the most senior guide working on the mountain these days.
After the first fall on last Thursday, in which Jeremiah O'Sullivan broke his leg, Staley stabilized Jeremiah O'Sullivan at 19,500 feet and then attempted to reach the lower camp down at, I believe, 17,000 feet. Anyway, they separated at that point. Why was that?
Well, they separated at some point while descending together. They initially began their descent together and got a bit spread out during the descent. The winds weren't that strong that Dave felt they could still launch Chinooks to get Jerry on the upper mountain, but he had to get word out. And the only way he could get word out, because the radio he had wasn't working and the sat phone that he had wasn't working, was to get down and raise the alarm.
It looks like Mr. Niederer might have sustained an injury after the fall. Do we know anything more about his state? Has an autopsy been done?
It's my understanding that an autopsy either has been done or is in the process of being conducted. Both Dave and Lawrence felt that that it was very likely that he had sustained a significant injury to his shoulder and side, and this really affected his ability to travel on the upper mountain.
Was this the first death of a mountain trip client?
This was the first death of a mountain trip client that I would call a climbing accident. Unfortunately, we've had two fatalities in the last 5 years. Both were sudden cardiac deaths in people who you would never fit the profile of being at risk for cardiac death, one being a 21-year-old man and the other being an older gentleman who was an ultra-marathoner and long-distance cyclist and extremely fit.
Would your company consider changing any policies as a result of this accident?
We've given that a lot of thought, and I can't think of anything that we could have done differently. You know, it's easy to look back with the clarity of hindsight and change our decision-making, but as we look at the factors that were at play while the events were unfolding, it was a situation in which there were very, very few options open to those climbers.
Mountain Trip co-owner Todd Rutledge, climbing guide Dave Staley suffered serious frostbite injuries, climber Jeremiah O'Sullivan suffered a broken leg along with frostbite, and climber Beat Niederer was killed in that accident last Thursday. Students from the Southwest Alaska village of Kokanok near Lake Liamna now have a piece of their work in the nation's most honored institution, the Smithsonian. Its National Museum of the American Indian recently invited the kids to Washington, D.C. to share a book they've written about their local community and culture, which includes Aleut, Yupik, and Athabascan roots. APRN's Libby Casey caught up with them earlier this month.
The small village of Kokanok has a rich tradition of storytelling, but not many of them were written down. That changed with a new book created by the local kids all about their community. Head teacher Coulter Barnes explains.
We interviewed elders. The kids narrated a myth, like a local myth. We came up with our own history, some of the things, what it's like to live in our village now.
The book is full of not just the writings of the students, but their illustrations and photos and old archival pictures of life in the village of their grandparents' day. The project caught the eye of the Smithsonian's National Museum of the American Indian, which invited the students to Washington to share some of their stories. So earlier this month, the two dozen kids from first grade to 12th took the long flight, many of them leaving Alaska for the first time ever. They read their stories on stage at the museum, while projected images from the book showed behind them. 18-year-old Sherilyn Chuknock talked about the day she saw a porcupine that ended up becoming dinner.
I wanted something like different. People in Washington, they would never think of catching a porcupine and having it to eat.
Here's Sherilyn on stage at the museum.
After we caught the porcupine, I felt proud because I was the one who spotted it. In fact, 4 generations of my family enjoyed the porcupine that I spotted on that fateful day.
The story is about more than a porcupine, though. It's a day in the life of a teenager in Kokanok with family and friends.
All 4 of us sat around the fire and listened to the breeze and quietness. We looked up and saw an eagle sitting so majestic and proud on a tall tree. I noticed it was relaxing, just as we were.
A few days after reading at the museum, Sherilyn sat outside on a spring afternoon in the Smithsonian Sculpture Garden with her classmates and talked about the experience.
I was so nervous. There wasn't even that much people there. My knees were shaking just a little bit, but
It was fun.
Sherilyn wasn't the only one who overcame her nerves. 7-year-old Selena Song O'Daman performed too.
It was cool, but I was kind of shy to be on stage. That's my first time being in a museum.
Selena read a fable she wrote. Some of the stories dive into regional history, like Gregory Zakhar's about the local wars.
Because there was a big fight between the Russians and the Yupiks and Indians, and then it drove the Russians out of that region for a while, and they didn't come back for a couple of years.
Of all the sites in the nation's capital, from the Declaration of Independence to modern art, Gregory's favorite was a simple D.C. park.
We don't have parks where I come from. It's all wide open wilderness, and you could climb trees there. And at the place, a police officer guy got mad at us for climbing trees, and I didn't even know why he got mad. And he said, if you break a branch, it's like you could go to jail for that. And in Kakanak, you could just go around and cut down any trees you want. It's a good learning experience to come here and learn about all this stuff that you can't do here.
All the stuff you can't do in a big city like Washington. Gregory says it's cool, but he wants to live where he can hunt and not feel caged in. So by traveling outside, he's learned to appreciate home a lot more. Teacher Coulter Barnes says everything from riding bikes on pavement to visiting the zoo has been eye-opening.
And they got stuck in the barnyard looking at cows and goats. All the other kids are looking at pandas and elephants. Our kids were looking at animals they've never seen. This is a cow. This is incredible. They were so excited about it.
At the museum, the group spent time answering questions from Lower 48 kids about life in Alaska. They were the experts about whales and bears. And even though they've gone home, their book is staying at the Smithsonian, where the stories by kids like Gregory will have an audience.
I like to write all the time, and I feel happy that a bit of my writing got to be in a book that's in a museum.
So the kids from tiny Kakanak have contributed to the nation's treasure chest. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Aaron Selvig in Homer, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Maria Dudzak in Ketchikan. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company, and by
the Center for Distance Education at UAF, offering access to online courses from any location. Information at distance.uaf.edu/learn.
How do you get men to wear their life jacket when the fact is that 90% of boating-related fatalities in Alaska are men? Well, truthfully, most men won't listen to messages like this, but they might listen to you. Have them fill out a Pledge to Live card and make a promise to wear their life jacket every time they get in a boat. Every time. Get a Pledge to Live card at pledgetolive.org. Make them promise so they make it back alive. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.